Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
I'm George Chen, and this is SupDoc, where we discuss and dissect documentaries with guests from comedy, film, TV, and more. Today, we're talking about City of Gold with our guest comedian and actor Carl Hess. Carl is a big eater and has a food podcast called Yelling About Pate. Jonathan Gold is the first food critic to receive a Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of Los Angeles and its cuisine. He's also the subject of Laura Gabbert's 2015 documentary, City of Gold. Fun fact, they met because their kids went to the same school and Laura won a raffle prize of dining with Jay Gold. The film is both a sensory delight and a tour of LA guided by, as he calls himself, the fat man's Jason Bourne. City of Gold is available on iTunes, Amazon, and Hulu. And now, here's my conversation with Carl Hess. So, right now, I'm talking to Carl Hess. Hi, Carl.
Hey, thanks for having me.
We run into each other very randomly all the time.
Yes.
At auditions
On the grimmest, like, worst place to ever see someone you know, a commercial audition.
When I saw you last, I was supposed to be like a soccer coach, and did not have anything that resembles that at all.
Commercial auditions, casting studios are just like places of great sadness.
Yeah.
This is just like, everyone's head is down looking at their phone. No one wants to be there.
I just told someone they should do it, though. Like, a friend of mine who's like,
you can make a lot of money.
Yeah, it's good money.
It's just be prepared for... Just, you know, like comedy itself, there's not a lot of dignity entailed.
Man, I mean, I've found a way to basically, like, I can do those because I don't take it personally at all.
Right, exactly.
It's just like, and for you, it's just like, you're probably one of several of your type.
Right.
And so, you want to, like, it's kind of worse if you get a callback because then it's like...
Right, then you're like, I got a shot at this. And they're like, I didn't get it.
But also, like, it's like, even if I don't get it, I have to drive out to Santa Monica
right,
again.
Exactly.
Or whatever.
You're not going to get it, but please be in Santa Monica at 4 p.m. on a Friday.
Oh, my God.
Because we need to see you again.
Well, which is interesting. Like, what I've been trying to do, and maybe this gets into our topic for the day, which is City of Gold.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you got to go to a weird part of town... Do you, like, just look up, like, what is close by check out?
A lot of times when it comes to the Hollywood or the West Side, those are places that I might not normally go to eat. I mean, obviously, if there's a place I want to go, I'm going to go.
Yeah.
But, like, in my daily life, I'm not going to Hollywood on the West Side a lot. Mm-hmm. So, there's definitely, like, oh, I have a commercial in Hollywood. I'm going to swing by Saltzcure or something like that. Like, a place that I wouldn't normally drive to, but if I'm there anyway, I'm going to stop in.
Well, I kind of suggested this movie.
I love this movie.
Yeah.
It's kind of functions as like a love letter to Los Angeles and, of course, the food. But, you know, food as an access point to culture and, you know, the cultural landscape as a city as a whole. And Jonathan Gold is someone who obviously loves L.A., loves food. He's from L.A. So it's like a quintessential Los Angeles food movie. You can't. Plus, it's gorgeously shot. I mean, if you love L.A., you got to see this movie, even if you're not like a huge food person.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the reason I thought of it for you is that you are someone who runs a food podcast already.
Exactly.
Which is Yelling About Pate.
Yelling About Pate. And, you know, as someone who loves food, I've always looked up to Jonathan Gold. I mean, mm-hmm. his writing was my first exposure to like real good food writing, which I think was the same with a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I discovered a lot of stuff through him, like I think a lot of people have. So he kind of has like this mythic status in the LA food world. Well, I mean, he's the only food writer to win a Pulitzer Prize.
Right.
So
in 2007.
He has like the establishment credentials.
Yeah.
But he's also just like, he's so passionate about it. And it really comes through in everything that like he really fucking cares.
Mm-hmm.
And you see that time and time again in the movie where, you know, there's some restaurant that's like struggling and then he like writes them up and then mm-hmm. that like makes their life, you know, like he's like changed people's lives in like actionable, like fundamental ways, which I think is very cool, like to have that power as a writer.
Yeah.
The one part where the Ethiopian restaurant, Meals by Janae,
yeah,
and like she was doing well, then 9/11 happened, then like her business dropped the fuck off,
yeah,
and like her son was in medical school, and then like, you know, Jay Gold dropped like a hot review, and then it was like lines out the door every day, like
right.
That, like, you know, like changed that woman's life.
Yeah, Meals. I thought it was Gannett, but like
it might be Gannett. I always think Janae because it was French.
Jean Janae, yeah,
Jean Janae. Yeah, could be Gannett. I don't know.
I thought she said it in there, which is why the only reason why I say it.
Very good restaurant.
Amazing. Like I love that stretch of Fairfax, yes.
The tiny little Ethiopia, which is like mm-hmm. two blocks, but it has like five Ethiopian restaurants.
Yeah,
they're all good.
Coming from Oakland, I got to say, like, one of my favorite, I don't know if you actually have done much in Oakland, but, like, I lived in a neighborhood that was, like, kind of, like, not exclusively, but a bunch of Korean restaurants.
Okay.
Bunch of Ethiopian right. restaurants. And I was just like, why has the twain never met? Like,
right.
when has,
there's
like, an
divide.
Ethiopian and a Korean, like, gotten married and started their weird Kore-Ethiopian
right. plot,
which is just, like, you know, like... pig meat and like injera, you know.
I have my little brother used to live in Oakland. I've been up there a bunch. The one place that stands out is that place Camino.
I don't know if I know Camino.
They cook all their food over an actual fireplace, mm-hmm. so there's no stovetops or ovens. It's all cooked in a like a giant communal hearth.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic. And then the one place that I've always heard about but never been is Bake Sale Betty's.
Oh,
because
yeah.
John
I got some
and Vinny
opinions about
modeled
that.
Their fried chicken sandwich at Son of a Gun after Bake Sale Betty's. It was
really?
Like an homage.
Okay.
And then that's like the best. That like kicked off the whole fried chicken sandwich trend that we're in right now.
That, you, really? Oakland?
Yeah.
You think it's grunts? Because I got a lot of opinions about Bake Sale Betty. And
okay.
I have not had the John and Vinny one you're talking
okay,
about.
Okay, well, I don't know much about Bake Sale Betty except for the fact that they modeled their fried chicken sandwich after it.
Okay.
And that fried chicken sandwich is still probably the best that I've ever had.
So, yeah, the main thing I got is, are you a mayonnaise guy?
I'm a huge mayonnaise guy.
So, okay, so Bake Sale Betty, the problem I had with it, and I have not eaten there in years.
Okay.
Like, probably started as, like, it was just supposed to be, like, a bakery with, like, cookies and cakes.
Right.
And then this thing just blew the fuck up, like,
right.
hugely blew up for Oakland,
but
like
on
a block
its
of
own,
Oakland.
On the yeah. merit of its own deliciousness.
Right.
It wasn't, like, hyped in the media. It was just, like, word got out that it is the fucking good sandwich you need to try.
Right. And my thing about it, and as a mayonnaise guy, you can maybe feel me on this. It was, like, they do a slaw that's just a vinegar slaw.
Okay. And I like a vinegar slaw.
Yeah.
But sometimes you want that creaminess.
Yeah. Without the mayo, I have always found that it was, like,
a little dry.
Well, it's so more so that the bread gets soggy, and that kind of ruined it for me.
Okay.
To a way. And
I
think I've like talked to a lot of people about this.
Do you think the bread gets soggy because of like the excess vinegar off the slaw? Like, if you think it was a creamy mayo based slaw, the bread sogginess wouldn't be an issue.
Yeah, or I would do a layer of mayo on the bread that would
as
keep,
an insulation,
right? Because it's like, yeah, like the mayo would be a little bit of a barrier,
okay.
in my opinion. Or like if you, because it's like, I don't know, remember if they toast the bun or
okay.
not. They might be toasting the rolls. But yeah, without the mayonnaise, I was like, I literally want to just go there. I'm like, I want to bring my own mayo.
Right.
And then see if anyone else is like, can I have some of that?
Is
because
there any other
dry.
Sauce or spread aioli situation?
No.
Besides the slaw and the chicken,
if
what
we're
else
talking
are we
about
dealing
Bake Sale
with?
Betty, it's like a spicy vinegar slaw
okay.
that's like, you know, peppers, cabbage. The fried chicken, good. The roll, good.
Okay.
Without, I was like, I really feel like they made a bad error, and then everyone else around me is just like, I hate mayonnaise. It's gross. Nah.
Dude, we're in a weird time for mayo because, like, somehow mayo has gotten, like, racially charged, like,
okay.
in this whole, like, weird
it's
era
the La La
of, like,
land of condiments.
In this, like, resurgent era of white nationalism and, like, racial strife,
yeah.
somehow mayo has become, like, identified
milk.
With, like, white people. Yeah, and, like, milk. And it's like, no, everyone loves mayo. Let's not, like,
yeah.
pigeonhole
the
mayo.
The Japanese
some,
love
yeah,
mayo.
Yeah, exactly. Asians
the
love
Japanese
mayo.
Japanese love
like,
mayo.
Let's not pigeonhole mayo as some weird white person thing. That's ranch. If you want to shit on ranch, white people for drinking a weird white thing, that's ranch.
I tried to make some ranch the other day. I made like kind
mayo
of
mayo is worldly. It's cosmopolitan. It's Europe. It's
aioli.
Yeah.
Just like, call it aioli now.
Let's not fucking conflate mayo with any kind of bland white people stereotypes.
Yeah, yeah. I like that. Yeah, mayo is the ladybird of this
I love
year.
Mayo, and I find more and more that, people, I don't know. Like, when it comes to a fry condiment, mayo every time.
Oh,
ketchup?
Yeah.
I mean, fine, but
that's like
Belgian near
style.
As good as mayo.
Yeah, we're talking like Belgian style.
Yeah,
or, yeah
I like
the
that
European
style.
Yeah. So I haven't had the sandwich that you say references based on.
Okay,
Betty.
So it's at Son of a Gun, which is John and Vinny's second restaurant. They opened Animal to big acclaim. They had
Wait,
a show.
Is that the snout to tail kind
of
place?
So
I've heard about
this. They had like a show. Now they're like two of the biggest LA food guys. Mm-hmm. They have a bunch of restaurants. But Son of a Gun was kind of like their seafood place that they opened after the success of Animal over by 3rd and Fairfax there.
So kind of in that hood we're just talking about?
Yeah, near that like Hollywood Farmers Market.
Okay, more of that.
And it was a seafood restaurant, but it had this fried chicken sandwich on the menu. And I remember going there for the first time. Miles Thompson was working in the kitchen. He's now like gone on to become like one of the hot new chefs of LA. But back then he wasn't the head chef, but he was working there. And I just remember having this chicken sandwich. And this was before every place had a fried chicken sandwich.
Right.
I was like, oh, a fried chicken sandwich. Interesting.
So like 2011 or something?
Yeah, probably 2011-ish.
Yeah.
And it was just like so good. It like blew me away. And it immediately became like a thing. Like they still.
Yeah.
They sell, hundreds. It's like their thing.
If we're talking about going back to the Bake Sale Betty thing, like they had one location that is tiny. Basically, they just took over the sidewalk because it was a tiny storefront. And then they opened a second location in downtown Oakland that was doing crazy business.
Right.
But they just
on the sandwich, on the strength of the sandwich.
Yeah, just the sandwich. And I think they shut down just because it was like, we don't need this much headache.
Really? They shut it down?
They didn't need two stores.
Wait, they shut the original location down?
No, they shut down the downtown
Oakland
one.
Oh, wow. You
think
they'd be making money hand over fist?
Yeah, no, I think they were. I think I talked to someone. A friend of mine was working there. I mean, she's now like has some other crazy job, but she was working there, and it was like, yeah, they just shut it down. Like, it's like it was doing good business. They were literally like, it's just kind of more of a headache.
That's
interesting. We don't need the money. Like,
wow. Who doesn't need the money?
Well, I guess the first one does such bananas business.
It's just more of a headache than
they
it was
didn't
worth.
Even need to. And it shut down, like, one of my favorite delis. Like, if anyone, because, like, I think we have a huge chunk of Bay Area listenership because I'm from up there and Paco's
there.
Shout out
to the Bay.
There was right across the street from that place this amazing sandwich place, this Italian deli called Genova, which shut down, like, right around the time I moved.
R.I.P. Genova.
Yeah, exactly. It was like, I'm like, I think I can't move back to Oakland anyway. Just, like, Genova's gone.
All my bridges have been burned.
It's
my
weird.
Sandwich place is gone. I'm going to LA.
Well, watching this, like, because, like, I am a newcomer to Los Angeles.
Okay. And this is actually a great entry point into, like, the food landscape of Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's a great, like, primer for just kind of, like, what's LA food scene all about?
Right. And I think I've only watched it, like, this came out in 2016.
Yeah.
Like, I've only seen it since I've lived here. I'm wondering, like, it's on Hulu. I'm, like, wondering what someone, like, in Indiana thinks of this movie.
Yeah, I mean, it is obviously, like, a very Los Angeles-centric thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as much as it's about the man, it's also about the city. But I think if you're really into food and, you know, L.A. has kind of taken its place as one of the great food cities in the country. So if you're interested in food, I think even if you were just in Indiana or something, this would be an engaging watch. Mm-hmm. Probably not as accessible as someone in LA, because when you're in LA, you're like, oh, I've been to that place, or fuck, I gotta go to that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, if you're watching it from afar, it's kind of more just like, oh, wow, LA looks fucking cool.
Well, I mean, I guess it's like, I watch those Bourdain things, I'm like, I'm not going to Burma, or,
well,
you know, like,
here's the actual interesting point about that, though. That you, it's interesting you brought up Bourdain, because I remember his first LA episode for No Reservations, really showed
David
LA
Cho
in a light that I think a lot of people hadn't before.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this movie, City of Gold, does the same thing. So if you were someone in Indiana watching it, and this movie addresses this, everyone has preconceived notions about what LA is.
Mm-hmm.
And this movie does a great job of kind of showing you the real LA.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's valuable for viewers who have never been to LA, maybe never will, to see it and be like, oh, this is a completely different city than my set of preconceived notions. And it kind of shows you, like, the real LA and the LA that, like, most people who live here care about and live in and, you know, interact with.
Right. I mean, like, there's like the kind of the size and like basically having understanding now, like when I would come visit, I would just be like, I'm playing a show at The Smell.
Right.
And people would be like, okay, where are you going to be the next day? Because
right.
I'm not going down
exactly.
there. Like, it's so neighborhood centric. Mm-hmm.
And there's a really cool part where I guess he's like an architect or like an urban theorist.
Oh, Rainer Banham.
Yeah. He's talking about how LA was like the first postmodern city mm-hmm. because in the post-war era, every big major city expanded from a central point outward, mm-hmm. whereas LA had all these different constellations of central points, which all started expanding outward. And then those kind of expansions fused at the edges. And what you got was like this fucking mosaic of different centers
yeah.
with the edges rubbing up against each other. And he was like, that's kind of like the first like postmodern metropolitan growth. And then what you really have is a mega city of yeah. like 11 million people.
Man, did you ever read that City of Quartz book?
No.
Mike Davis, do you know about that book? I mean, like, honestly, I've never read the entire book.
Okay.
But it's like one of the major like books about LA that
I would
is
love to. That's interesting.
Yeah, it's like it's kind of when people talk about like postmodernism and stuff, like City of Quartz is like talking all about like the construction of LA or like this idea of LA right. too. So I've had all these ideas about LA forever, and like
especially coming from the Bay. I mean,
we live in this sort of like dyad of like it's like we the Bay Area exists like a sullen teenager to be like what the popular
right.
jock is doing,
right.
and that's LA, and it's almost just like, well, we're not that.
I know, I
and
know.
It's completely and I. It's a mind fuck for me being down here in a way, you know.
Coming from, I mean, I grew up on the East Coast, and coming to California, the first like thing that I realized about the dynamics of California overall, because my brother has lived up in the Bay for many years, mm-hmm. was that everyone in the Southland loves going up to the Bay and San Francisco, and we all look at that city and we're like, the culture, the food, and then everyone up there just shits on LA unreservedly.
Yeah.
But it's like you said, it's like, I mean, it's LA gets all the shine, and I think a lot of the hatred coming out of SF is just because of, you know, it's like LA is this thing and we're defining ourselves by being not that thing.
Yeah.
Plus, SF is like, you mean now like LA, the food scene and culturally like it's having its moment in the sun, but traditionally LA wasn't a food place. It was like SF was one major food city. You had Chicago, New York, SF, you know, and LA wasn't really part of that national conversation. But now you have this massive influx of talent and energy, and everyone wants to be part of LA, and LA is finally getting its moment in national food press and attention and all these hot restaurants. So it's like, it's an exciting time to be here.
Yeah. Well, I'd say like in general, it seems like what's happened is every field, there's almost more of every option in Los Angeles.
And I think a big part of it is, especially when it comes to chefs who want to open a restaurant, which is such a costly endeavor, people are getting priced out of New York and SF. I mean,
totally.
It's hard to fucking open anything, but a restaurant, Jesus Christ, the amount of money needed. If you're a young chef and you want to do your own thing, it's like, that's why Chinatown neighborhood in LA and Koreatown in the last 6 years has exploded, because they were neighborhoods that had
cheaper rents.
Had cheap rent. I mean, David Chang just opened a restaurant in Chinatown.
Is it open now?
It's open.
Okay.
As of this week.
Oh, wait. You know, I think we just looked it up. It's called like Mondo.
Major Domo. So it's like these neighborhoods, and you know, as it is in the Arts District downtown, which used to just be warehouses, it's like these neighborhoods where it's cheap and you can do something on the cheap and open something cool that you want to do. And then, you know, that creates energy. More people start moving in. And, it, you know, it's like the story that happens again and again and again.
Yeah.
With any kind of scene, any kind of cultural thing.
Where are you? You're from Philly?
Yeah, I grew up in Philly. And, you know, Philly is, I would say, is a top five food city in the country. I mean, people fucking love food. The food is great. It's obviously, there's a huge Italian influence. I just grew up just having great pizza and hoagies and cheese. You know, that was just like part of my childhood.
Do you have an opinion on this Geno's, Pat's? Like,
you know, I was never a Geno's or Pat's guy. I was kind of, I liked Jim's.
Yeah, it's like, sort of like, I don't like the Beatles or the Stones. I like the Kinks.
Well, you know, Geno's and Pat's are fine.
Yeah,
I think the whole like rivalry is kind of dumb.
Which one's the more racist one?
Geno's.
Geno's?
I mean,
I've saw some stuff.
Gradations of racism.
It's like, it's a pretty,
right.
It's like, yeah.
It's like a tourist trap thing. I mean, Jim's has a couple locations. Jim's was the place where, like, you know, I grew up in the suburbs, like 15 minutes outside the city. If we were downtown, you know, and we would go to gyms. It was like, mm-hmm. fuck yeah. Like,
okay.
you know, you'd get the whole thing. You'd get like the surly guys behind the counter. It was like the whole, mm-hmm. like the classic Philly cheesesteak experience for me is gyms. You got to
okay.
order right. You got to whiz wit. You know, you got to do uh-huh. the thing. The guy will yell at you if you're holding up the line. So yeah, gyms is, but then, you know, there's shit like Tony Luke's. And Tony Luke's was the first place I had, like within Philly, I think just as important as the cheesesteak is the Italian roast pork sandwich, which isn't as okay. well known outside of Philly.
I think I had, when I was there, which is now it's been so long, it was like 2009 or something, but I think my friend did take me to get
yeah,
one of those.
It's like,
yeah.
you know, you get roast pork, you have sharp
peppers.
Provolone,
uh-huh.
long hots, the peppers,
yeah.
and then broccoli rabe to give you some of that bitterness.
Yeah.
And, you know, a good Italian roast pork sandwich. Ooh, that's mm-hmm. one of the best sandwiches ever.
Yeah, I think I was not into the peppers. Maybe it was just.
Yeah, I mean, when you're a kid, I remember trying it at Tony Luke's, and you know, the broccoli rabe is bitter, and mm-hmm. and the provolone's very sharp and aggressive. And I was like, "This isn't for me. I want my mm-hmm. cheesesteak with you know." Back then, I was putting ketchup on my cheesesteaks. I didn't yeah. know what the fuck I was doing.
Now, is there a transition where you because like here's the thing about like being into like food culture? Like I would say, maybe like. Everything is like the new punk rock, right? Like
right,
a while ago,
exactly.
like 15 years ago, food was the new punk rock. Then like comedy was the new
this,
punk
this
rock.
This is actually, my podcast I host with a chef and mm-hmm. like we always laugh because it was like, which one's the new punk rock?
Yeah.
Is it comedy and food? It can't be both at the same time.
It can't be both.
What's
of those.
Punk rock now? Is punk rock food?
Well, I also like food and comedy like fulfill like different, like I would not want to have like most comedians I know with their dirty
right.
hands,
like exactly.
handling food for me.
I think it was like, and we talked, this was kind of like the central thesis of our podcast was that like food and comedy kind of both entered this thing where like chefs are the rock stars. And then
yeah.
it's like, and now, you know, we're in quote unquote the second golden age of stand up where it's like everyone's interested in comedians' lives and there's all these shows about comedians and comedians are the new rock stars. So it's like,
yeah.
like these figures become lionized in the culture where it's like, he's the bad boy chef or he's the
oh, God.
Tell it like it is truth talent comedian. And it's like, it's just funny. And like, you know, we try to, you know, satirize that and
yeah.
poke fun at every turn that we can. But it's funny like that we don't have any other way to talk about it but by comparing it to like rock star, you know, like
yeah.
our like cultural conception of like what cool is so tied to music
yeah.
that it's like it's the only way we have to, like, oh, he's a rock star chef. It's like, we need a better term than that.
Dude,
he just has tattoos. He's not a rock
star. It's actually worse probably in Silicon Valley because they would just have like a monster listing or something like,
right.
we need a rock star coder.
Well, I think you know, like, when it comes to like subverting shit, like obviously
yeah.
you can think back to rock and roll and then punk rock as cultural touchstones of what kind of movements did that.
Right.
And I think it's easy. Everyone has that kind of like shared collective consciousness about that. But we need a better vocabulary for all of this.
Yeah. I mean, like, it's like maybe like, let's say, okay, well with punk rock, you have like people that were in it for like political reasons or
right,
anarchist
exactly.
reasons. So like you got crust punks. I'm like, I don't want to eat at a crust punk restaurant.
Right.
Like, but then there's people that are like literally the guys from Green Day invested in a restaurant called, well, like at least one, the bass player is one of the owners of Rudy's Can't Fail.
Right.
Which is also like another like, you know, stupid music reference.
Right.
And it's just a really not so good diner.
Right,
that has like
right.
two or three locations in the Bay. I think
right.
maybe they're in the Oakland airport now. And it's like, well, that, yeah, that makes sense. Like there's like, that's is commercial, like just it is like pop
right.
punk.
Yeah.
It's like mainstream pop
right,
punk.
Exactly. Monetizing
it's like,
it.
Yeah. You glossed it up and you
right.
made it safe for teenagers.
The lines have blurred so much. It's like,
yeah,
fucking the guy from the Beastie Boys is a sommelier at a fucking hot restaurant now. And you know, Nas sells chicken and waffles. So it's like, well,
right.
yeah, we're through the looking glass. It's
yeah, and then celebrity like actors have restaurants, and like
sure.
doesn't James Franco have a restaurant?
Probably.
Like maybe he has to get out of now.
They got to force him out. Silent partner.
Yeah, yeah. I was gonna get to with that is like, you know, like I'm someone who would just like be all about just efficiency and cheap eating,
right?
And like I think when this trend started to happen, which I kind of would put it maybe early 2000s.
Right.
It was like, I was just like, I feel like kind of anti it in a certain way.
Right.
And it was just like, not like I was doing anything particular. I just was like not concerned about food other than as like fuel
right.
for other stuff I was doing. And then I was wrong, I think. I think I was wrong to think about it that way. Now it's also like my relationship to like pleasure was different maybe.
Right.
When you're young and you're like angry and you're like, I don't want to enjoy like
right.
the sensory things of the world.
Enjoying shit is bourgeois.
Right. And like maybe it's a weird thing. I was thinking about this for me personally because like I don't drink at all. And okay. I feel like that actually is like next to being vegan, probably a big like barrier to like enjoying. Like,
if I didn't drink, I mean, food would be, you know. Food, sex, and drinking are like the big three. You take away one, you know, you have to put more emphasis on the other two.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, well...
or drugs. Drinking drugs are one category.
I mean, without getting too specific. And now, like, I feel like, yeah, like, my relationship to it now is different. But also, it was just like a money thing. It was like a class thing.
Right.
And it was like being in the Bay Area early 2000s, like, after a dot-com crash, and then, like, being like... go into that restaurant is bougie, you know, like yeah. that was like my attitude a long time. Did you have that at some point
well,
and change your mind
I think
about it? Or
in like the longer, like the bigger scope, you know, what we've seen in the last two decades is like the democratization of food and mm-hmm. kind of the decentralization of like fine dining. And like, you know, now it's all about like elevating bar food. So it's like, oh, right. we're taking shit that was traditionally blue collar or for poor people, and then we're elevating that cuisine. Mm-hmm. And that's been a long time in the making of, you know, it used to be like if you wanted really good food, you had to go to like a fine dining place. And
yeah.
the death of fine dining and kind of, you know, the atomization of our culture at large and, you know, specifically in the food world is that's like, if you look back, that's like the longer term trend.
Mm-hmm. It's actually better. You're saying like the higher end like couldn't sustain itself, and then it led to more. It's like you could say it's like the comedy club scene,
right?
Like when all the comedy clubs crashed,
yeah,
because it couldn't sustain.
Yeah,
but then there became a million bar shows.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting that we were talking about like what's punk rock, because you know Jonathan Gold was a punk rock kid.
Yeah,
he grew up playing in punk rock bands, so he kind of came to it from that. And like I was saying, it's like we need to find a new vocabulary. But what I think punk rock, like one of the ethos of it is like DIY.
Yeah,
and I think that ethos is like important if you're like trying to start your own thing in anything. So it's like
yeah.
an independent comedy show in a basement like you used to run, or like a pop-up restaurant. Like that DIY aesthetic I think permeates anything cool that people are trying to get off the ground on their own. And you know, in that respect, it is kind of funk rock.
Yeah. And well, I mean, I would also, that's why I always compare like podcasting to like zine culture too.
Right. Yeah, exactly. It's like
a similar
just
thing.
Directly access the people that you want to access, and here's what I did, and you take a look at it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, overall, I mean,
for you personally though, like was there a point where you're like, I can't go out, and then you're just like, I can go out?
Well, the thing is, like, you know, growing up, I didn't really, like, going out was like a treat. Like, mm-hmm. I remember we would go out every Friday to, like, a restaurant called Alpha House, and it was, like, a standing Friday dinner, and I would get a cheesesteak, and I'd be like, yes, this is great, I'm at a restaurant. So I
like a local
going.
Chain, like a Pennsylvania chain?
No, it was
chain?
Just, like, a
just
mom and pop little
oh, really?
Italian spot called uh-huh. Alpha House, and it was just, like, you know, my parents would get, like, fucking linguine with crab meat, and I would get a fucking cheesesteak with no onions.
Sounds so good.
You know,
right
I was a very picky eater as a kid, so mm-hmm. I'd go, no onions, and I'd put ketchup on it out of the glass Heinz bottle. So going out was always like, I always loved restaurants, but like we didn't like eat out a lot. Like, so it was always a treat. And then when I got to college, I always loved eating, but I ate like garbage in college.
Yeah,
like,
everyone
I ate
does.
Panda
like,
Express,
no one
and Subway.
Eats well. Like, who eats well
yeah.
in college?
And I always enjoyed eating and had a big appetite,
yeah.
but like I never cooked. I never cooked in college.
Yeah,
one
why
time.
Would you?
Yeah, yeah. So I mean, and the thing is, like watching this movie, like I look back on those years that I spent at USC as like wasted time, because like I could have been like discovering the city and like getting down and like finding all the shit out, but like I didn't have a car. I was in that little college bubble. I ate fucking
you went to USC
I went to USC yeah. I ate bad food. But I remember the first time we went to this place, Dino's Chicken, which is this classic place on Pico, and it was like the first time that I like discovered a place. I mean, obviously it's like an LA institution and I found that out later, but like we just kind of saw it while we were driving.
Yeah,
because we used to actually go to this place, Papa Christo's, which was another little find that we kind of stumbled upon, this longtime Greek marketplace. And we were like, oh, this like place Dino's Chickens, this looks good. And then we were like blown away by it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like you have that experience, and then you it kind of makes you think like, oh wow, there's like there's like a lot of stuff I don't know about, and you start exploring it more.
Yeah.
But like that didn't really happen for me. Like I was still like pretty content to just eat garbage shit until I went to Asia for 6 months after college.
Okay.
And so I was in Thailand and Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia, and like it just like fucking like
I bet.
I had no frame of reference for that. Like uh-huh. I didn't like Thai takeout at USC, but like going to Vietnam and Thailand was just like, it was like an acid. It was like, it changed like fucking everything mm-hmm. I thought about flavor and just like, I mean, it was unbelievable. When I came back, I literally ate nothing but Thai food for like 6 months. That's when I started just going to Thai Town, and like I went to Jitlada, went to Sap Coffee Shop, started being like, holy shit, like mm-hmm. it's all here. You know, like LA has the biggest populations of. Sure.
Yeah, that reminds me, like we mentioned that Jonathan Gold did come from a music background. It's interesting, he's trained as a classical cellist.
Yeah, and a classical cellist who started playing in punk bands, which is also very interesting.
Well, we went to a screening of this. It was him and the director, Laura Gabbert, were there, and I actually found a record that he plays cello on, and they had him sign it for
That's
me.
That's awesome.
And he was like, wow, I haven't seen this in years.
Punk rock is sort of what got me out of my shell, and somebody dragged me to the Whiskey to see a show of, you know, X and the Screamers. I was just, you can do this? It's possible to do this? And it was as transforming as anything I've ever done. All your time been keeping gone. Realize
all your lies. Hide behind your suits and ties. Your life you lead, your mouth to be. You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
If today's episode got you thinking about food, which it and obviously it inevitably does, you know, we didn't actually have this on hand, but I wanted to talk about our sponsor for the day. We got a sponsor, a friend of mine who makes hot sauces right here in California from Meyer Lemons, dried and smoked chili peppers and garlic. And it's Hoppin' Hot Sauce, Paco. You like hot sauce on your food? You like it on tacos?
Love it.
What else do you
tacos,
like?
Tacos, pizza, popcorn, ice cream, hamburgers, hot dogs, burritos.
I've never really put hot sauce on a hamburger, but I like A1 on a hamburger. But I would try it. I would try it on with vinegar and French fries. And I've been trying to do a little bit more home cooking. If you're trying to do some home cooking and you want to get away from these corporate oligarch hot sauces, the hot sauce industry.
Tabasco.
Yeah, if you want to get away from big hot sauce, you can support artisanal local hot sauces. Go to hoppinhotsauce.com to find out more about it. It's perfect for our theme of the day, talking about Jonathan Gold and the movie City of Gold. There's so many spices in this movie. You just want to get spices over everything. So if you've watched City of Gold and you want to try a new hot sauce, check out hoppinhotsauce.com.
Like music and comedy, there's a big parallel and connection between music and food.
Just like they're creative forms, but this is the only one where it's like you literally consume it, you know?
Right. Yeah. Plus, like going back to that vocabulary we have of like talking about everything through music. I mean, you know, there's a podcast called Food is the New Rock, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, we all love music. Like every comedian kind of wants to be a rock star. I mean, I think every chef in their mind, you know, kind of was. So it's like music, it kind of just like the thing that like ties it all together.
Yeah. Know? I mean, you could say this sort of this, we go back to this whole rock star idea, but also It's interesting because Jonathan Gold just put out piece where he's talking about like women kind of coming back into the center of, of cooking. And
a male-dominated world in the higher ends of the chef world for a very long time.
Yeah, and like I was thinking about that too in this relationship of like with like Bourdain or people where it's like it's become like the cult of personality around the chef. And it's kind of a weird macho competitive
I think Bourdain was an important contributing factor to that. And and to his credit, he now kind of calls it out as bullshit. But like when Kitchen Confidential was published, I guess late 90s, early 2000s, it was like it kind of set up the archetype of the bad boy chef. And I think it was such a big hit because everyone kind of wanted that dirt on like, ooh, the bad boy chef, they're doing drugs. They're in the, you know, so I think that kind of bad boy chef rock star archetype was really cemented by that. And I think that's what, you know, it's not like Bourdain was ever a great chef. I mean, I'm sure he's good at cooking, but like he was rocketed to stardom because of that. The strength of that that archetype has in all our minds of like the bad boy guy. And he's a punk rock guy. So it's like,
or like Jerry Stahl or someone like that. Like
he did heroin and went to Velvet Underground shows or whatever. And it's like that that is equated to cool in a very like hardwired way for a lot of people.
And that feels like a very East Coast New York-y kind of approach.
Exactly. And he's like a trash talking New York guy. And like, you know, and I think later on in his career, to his credit, I think he's called himself out on it, and he's always kind of been a little self-effacing, and he can make fun of himself. He doesn't take himself too seriously. But I think that he was kind of like a very important milestone in that road of like where we get to the rock star chef, the bad boy chef, the kind of that mythos, that cult of personality.
When there was that episode, I think it's that LA episode we were just talking about where he's hanging out with David Cho, who is like that to like the nth degree, like just like come on, like a little too much. And then also hanging out with Roy Choi, I think, and on that episode.
That was a very important so when No Reservations first went onto Netflix, I watched like every single episode. Love that show.
Jollibee. I still haven't had it.
And like I said before, like that first LA episode where it's basically all about Koreatown was like so cool to see because it was like he really did LA right, you know, and you know, he was in, he knew that Koreatown was going to be, obviously the Koreans always knew it, but like, you know, in the last 6 years, Koreatown's exploded. Everyone's open restaurants there. It's a hot nightlife place. And, you know, he knew, and, you know, Roy Choi, of course, obviously was a big part of that, that it was like Koreatown's the place to be. Like, let's focus most of the show on Koreatown. This is where all the exciting shit's happening culinary wise. And, you know, I mean, I fucking love Koreatown, and that episode was really like an eye. There's over 900 restaurants in Koreatown.
That's right. He's actually
Jay Gould says that in the movie. Like you could eat out in Koreatown every day for multiple years and never go to the same place.
Man, did you ever go to the ramen burger place?
You know, I never did. Yeah, but I've had a ramen burger. I don't think I ever went to that one place. So.
Yeah, it's weird. It's weird when you try to explain it to someone.
Didn't
like,
love a ramen
it's
burger.
It's like, how do you eat noodles as a bun? Yeah,
didn't love it. Well, that's the thing. Like, you know,
the wrapper was so weird.
Yeah, like Roy Choi made a Korean taco,
right?
And it was so good. And
it was like 2011,
right?
Or so.
Yeah, Kogi like kicked off the whole food truck thing. But that taco was like a very good taco. Like the ramen burger to me was like a novelty, and like it's not better than eating ramen or a burger.
Right.
So it's like, what are we doing? This, this is just for Instagram.
The bad hybrid.
I think with Kogi, the reason that it was so successful and you know, spawned kind of like a whole movement is because like it was fucking good.
Yeah.
Like you had that short rib taco, and you were like, I couldn't get this experience eating Korean short ribs or eating a taco. Like this is something new. It's more than the sum of its parts. And yet it's immediately familiar
because
I love both those things. Ramen burger, you don't get that.
Do you think Jay Gould fucks with like the kind of the hybridized, Californiaized things? Like there's like the sushi Rito or anything
sure
like that? Are those
tries
things just
it.
Like trends?
I don't, I feel like he has to try everything. But yeah, I always draw the line between like, you know, like there's all these Instagram trends, whether it's like rainbow food or like that teardrop cake or, you know, whatever it is. And then I think there's trends that are based on shit being really good, like the cronut. Like if you have a cronut, it's fucking delicious. Like you're not going to have that and not be like, if you have the actual cronut, like it's very good. Like sure, there's knockoffs and it becomes a thing unto itself. But like, I think there's a difference between shit that pops off just for Instagram. Like, yeah. Oh, it's charcoal ice cream. It's like soft serve, but it's black. It's like, okay, who cares? Like, does it taste good? Does it taste like normal ice cream?
Instagram is responsible for so much stuff right now.
You know, chefs are designing their restaurants to be photographed and Instagram influencers. And I love Instagram. I'm on it all the time. But the way that it's come to affect food culture, I think a lot of the times, you know, it's more sizzles than steak, and a lot of shit takes off as a trend just because it looks cool.
Yeah, totally.
And like, I'll try anything. Like, yeah, sushi burrito. Give me a shot.
Yeah,
you know, I'm always down to try it. But like, I think a lot of these trends, they don't have the substance. And when something comes along that is a game changer, like Roy Choi's taco, you know, you see the impact of it.
Yeah.
It's like that taco launched 1,000 imitators, a fleet of restaurants and trucks, and a whole culture.
I was going to shout out another thing, which I don't know, maybe you know if there's something equivalent down here, but there is Indian pizza. That's one thing in the Bay that's...
Did you ever used to be this place called Cowboys and Turbans in Silver Lake, which kind of tried to combine Mexican and Indian. And it was fine, but they never really got it right, and it's closed now. And yeah, there would be like, you know, you'd have like curry and a burrito, and there was Indian pizza, but like
that they just seems theoretically good,
right? And no one's done it right.
Yeah.
I always used to go to Cowboys and Turbans. I gave them many chances, and I was like, maybe better this time. And it was always just like fine.
Yeah,
it was never bad. And I was like, that concept, and this is actually an interesting thing.
It's right there. I can visualize what it would be. Yeah.
And I think Indian food. What's happening with that place Badmash downtown?
I
think a lot of the times with Indian food, people have this very specific idea of what it is, because they're like, when I get Indian, I get Indian, and it's like this, and I get these dishes, and it's, you know, tikka masala, and it's like, you know, like Mexican food, India is a fucking subcontinent. It's huge. There's so much regional shit. It's like what the common person thinks of Indian food is a very tiny fraction. And I think, maybe in the United States as a whole, but definitely in LA, for me at least, it's like, I don't think there's a lot of, like, there's not like an Indian place that's like changing it. Like Badmash, which is like a hip Indian gastropub that opened downtown, was like, this is like Indian food in a way that you don't see a lot. You know, it was kind of like Indian food out that existing outside of all of our preconceived notions about it, which I think why it's done really well. But yeah, like with Cowboys and Turbans, I was always like, someone could do this way better.
Yeah.
And kind of present Indian food in a way like Roy Choi did with Korean food, fusing it with Mexican food,
like
that could do really well.
Some second generation kid coming in and doing that or something.
And maybe I'm just not going to the right Indian place. I know like Artesia, there's a little
India. I don't know. Actually, Fremont in the Bay Area has like this huge Indian population.
Right.
So like I have friends that would just go to Fremont to get like Indian food. Like there's Paru's down the street here, which is a vegetarian, which I'm partial to, but I'm not like...
There's definitely like good Indian places.
Yeah, and there's a little Bangladeshi area, they said, that right by Koreatown,
yeah,
right?
That's actually... it's kind of tucked in right by like Westlake. It's like little Bangladesh. I don't think there's many Bangladeshi restaurants, though.
Really?
I think it...
That was in that Bourdain thing, I
think.
Yeah,
I think it like got
it.
That status because like there was a bunch of Bangladeshi people who lived there. Or...
Oh, it's not like actually...
I mean, there's got to be some restaurants. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe we go on a Bangladeshi food mission.
Yeah, we should do that. I was also going to... Like, I was thinking about how this movie, in my mind, also represents writing in a way that I don't think you see in movies very well. Like, I was comparing this, in my mind, to like... I just watched that Joan Didion documentary,
it's
good, but like watching a guy kind of have writer's block is fascinating to me.
And I love the part where it's like, you know, this is focusing on him and how he's good at writing, and you hear some passages read, and he's like, he's very eloquent. And then you get the perspective of his editor, and she's like,
yeah,
this is kind of a nightmare for me. Like, and then you start to see that he's a huge procrastinator, and like, in order for him, like the one lucky peach guy is like, it, like in order to be his editor, you would have to like constantly harass him.
From
New
York.
And I think for any creative people that resonates, because like
totally,
we all have that urge to like just procrastinate, and like you know you have something to do and you put it off.
Oh my god!
You like have a writing deadline, you're like, fuck, I don't want to do it, but you finally get it done.
Yeah,
but the internal prodding and the external prodding it takes, I really identified with that. Like I was like glad to see that even a Pulitzer Prize winner is doing the same shit that like I'm fucking doing.
Yeah, that was fascinating to me. Like, and also like the way he kind of is like, He says one line, like, when he's, like, doing a UCLA commencement speech, he's like, did the things I do in... He's also like, I think about failure all the time. Like, I live in this thing of failure. I'm like, you see me as a successful? I'm a failed cellist.
Right, exactly.
In my mind.
Yeah, he brings an interesting perspective, and I think... You know, like, the act of writing isn't very sexy. Like, everything surrounding it and the culture of it is sexy. But, like, a man sitting alone in a room tapping on a laptop is not sexy.
No.
But I think this shows, like, the side of, like, just kind of sitting with your own thoughts and having to figure it out. That's, like, this is what writing is.
Yeah. Like, it's it actually not, like, is... the post when you see, like, a guy setting type and being calling down, like, run it.
Writing's not sexy.
It's not.
And this movie does a good job of showing all sides of it and showing the people who have to work with Jonathan Gold and being like, yeah, getting him to finish some shit is
and married to an editor.
He's married to an editor.
On top of everything else.
Yeah,
he's
and the one part where he's like, the way she goes about it, it's maybe not great for the marriage, but it's good for my writing. Like, she doesn't actually edit his work anymore.
Right, not anymore. But
it's a funny dynamic.
And they met at the LA Times
and
stuff.
Yeah.
There is
any editor watching this movie is probably like, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. But yeah, again, like, you're like comparing it to like a movie where it's like, it's about the impact of the thing. Like, you don't sit there with a guy who's just like, I'm blocked.
Right.
I'm here is
sit
me
there for 5 hours
going
at
to
his
Google
desk.
Translate and looking at trying to figure out Chengdu by going to, and I do like he says, I'm, assume that the reader doesn't really know any more than I do.
Right.
And we are starting from, even though he's been doing this forever.
Even though he does know way more than you.
He does.
He never really lords it over you.
About like everything. I mean, there was a scene where like when he was doing music writing, he was in the studio with Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg.
Yeah. Yeah. That's actually a really cool. I mean, talk about being like plugged into the culture of LA. He was like in the sessions when they're recording like the first Chronic.
Yeah.
Like, Jay Gold's been on the scene, man.
Which is funny.
He was there.
When I see this picture of young Jonathan Gold with like his sunglasses and his beard, I'm like, he looks like Rick Rubin. I mean, like, they look like, I'm like, in a similar way. I'm like, those are disruptors.
Yeah,
right?
They're just like,
Rick Rubin's a disruptor and like a synthesizer.
Just fucking bearded dudes doing weird shit.
Yeah. Like, he's a really interesting. He's just a really interesting dude. That's one thing you get out of this. It's about LA.
Right.
It's about this particular guy.
Right.
And then it's also about like criticism and journalism.
Right.
And like he says even like he's like criticism is criticism. He's like a symphony is kind of like a good boiled potato. I'm like, that's a great line, great quote.
And they do a good job of like, you know, in our society when everyone's a critic and they talk about Yelp, they do a good job of like explicating like the critic's role, and like they talk about how like he's not just a food critic, he's a cultural commentator,
right?
And like they do a good job of fleshing out the definition of what a critic is and what a good criticism should mean, where like it gives you context.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like the critic has done his homework. Sure, you can go on Yelp and, you know, figure out what restaurant you want to eat at, but like if you want someone who has years of experience and context and can bring all of that to bear on their opinions, and it's like, you need to go to a fucking professional group.
And like a lot of what this is it's also the story of like immigration. And
yeah, it's a story of LA as a whole.
Yeah.
And one man as a man, but he's also so quintessentially LA,
mm-hmm.
you know, like being part of the West Coast hip hop and being part of the punk rock and, you know, growing up in LA is like, so it kind of, it really ties everything together very nicely.
Now, other than doing your podcast, do you feel like you've done criticism or you've done any like sort of like commentary about someone else's art?
Not
because
really.
I feel like that's what a lot of podcasting ends up being.
Yeah, I mean,
firstly,
our podcast is pretty loose. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm looking at your notes here. Like, I wish I was this organized.
I just like jotted.
I mean, the thing
I
is,
I
want
to remember every restaurant, what neighborhood it's in, so I could go later. Yeah.
The thing about our podcast is like, Joel is a chef.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he has the restaurant. He's an executive chef, but he also loves comedy, and I'm a comedian. I do stand up, but I fucking love food. So I think it's like two people who like mutually respect each other. Like, I respect Joel as a chef. He respects me as a comedian. I respect that he likes comedy, and mm-hmm. he respects that I love food. So we kind of have, so like when we talk about a restaurant, like I'm, you know, I would never say that I'm like critiquing it like Jonathan Gold would, but I do think that we're both coming at it from a really passionate angle and a place where it's like, you know, Joel does this for a living. I do comedy for a living. It's like, we are in a position to speak to some things mm-hmm. authoritatively.
Yeah.
I don't think we're on the level of criticism like Jonathan Gold is doing, but like, you know, we have informed opinions about
it. Who's going to get a Pulitzer for the first podcast?
Right, exactly. You know? There's going to be a podcast Pulitzer in our lifetime.
It's going to be the Daily. It's going right. to be like something
It'll
like
It'll be like Pod Save America. I'll be like, damn it.
Totally. But like, not just that. What do you think makes for a better guest on your show? Is it someone who comes from the food world or someone who comes from the comedy world?
I don't think it matters. We kind of alternate between chefs and comedians. I just want someone who's engaging and passionate, and most, you know, all our guests have pretty much fit that bill.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we talk a lot about food opinions, and, you know, Jill and I are on the same page about a lot of stuff, but like, who doesn't love a good food argument, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's like sports or anything or movies. You know, you have your opinions, and it's like I'll push for mayo.
Mm-hmm.
Like I'll
mm-hmm.
I'll get in an argument about mayo. I got an argument about mayo the other day.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, mayo's the best condiment. Like, come at me. So, yeah, I think we just, like, our favorite guests are just people who are passionate and, mm-hmm. and can speak to it in a funny, engaging way.
Yeah.
And, you know, when we're all having fun, you know, doing the podcast, like, when you're engaging it, you're having fun. And,
yeah.
Like, that's the whole point. It's just like comedy.
Yeah.
It's like, if you're not having fun, no one else is going to have fun.
I had, before all this stuff, like, for a while, I wanted to be like a music journalist.
Right.
Like that was like my goal.
Right.
For a while, which is so weird to think about now. Like that was a goal that I had.
Well, and you're a young man. You're very into music. You're playing in bands.
Yeah.
You know, it seems somewhat logical. If you're not going to be a musician, be someone who writes about the thing that you love.
Well, that was a weird step where I sort of was doing all those things simultaneously.
Right. Right.
And then I was like starting to be in this position where I'm like, oh, I can't really shit on this band because I'm friends with them.
Right.
And it's going to come back to bite me in the ass.
Right. You're in a small kind of social circle in the Bay where everyone knows each other.
And like, and it's like, and then like, I started to get neurotic about that. And then I started to be like, well, wait, I kind of want to be the person making the stuff and not the person commenting on the stuff.
Right.
And so that kind of just gradually became more of the thing. And I kind of like, with Jonathan Gold too, I kind of like wonder how much, like, you know, the last scene you show him after the credits, like cooking a meal for his family, but he's not like heavily, you know, he eats out all the time professionally.
Right.
So I don't know what his relationship to his food is, or his criticism. It's not like if he was still doing classical music reviews and thinking about being a cellist, it would be a different world. And I guess similarly, like I've never seen journalism about comedy is very difficult as well. I've seen like just journalists like just like paraphrase punchlines, jokes, and it's like,
or
just
get them
don't
wrong.
Do it. Just don't do that if
you're
going to do that.
Just like food and taste, like it taste and culture, or literal taste in your mouth, taste buds. You know, shit's subjective. Comedy and food are subjective. Like, one person can love a dish, another person can hate it. One person could think a joke's fucking hilarious, another person can hate it. So I think, mm-hmm. you know, an important part about journalism or criticism and writing about these things that are so subjective is to realize that
mm-hmm.
and kind of approach it like, you know, with that informing the way that you're going to try to communicate ideas.
Yeah, right. I mean, like, I think like a lot of it'll just be like, there'll be like a profile on a comedian the way there's a profile on a musician
or a
chef. It's just like the backstory.
Right. Here's the story. Everyone wants the narrative.
Right.
You know, and you know, all these chefs, they have, you know, it's all about the personal narrative now. And the same thing with a comedian, because comedians speak about their life on stage for the most part. So that personal narrative is so important in, you know, when someone's profiled.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, it's a weird thing to try to break down into words weird subjective sensations in your mouth or brain, you know.
It's
like, that's the whole thing about writing. It's like, it's the stumbling block for a lot of people is that, like, it's really hard to convey some of this shit.
Well, I listened to a couple episodes of your podcast, and I feel like you get the enthusiasm for everything that you guys are into there. And I was thinking about it compared to like food, I think, is something that photographs very well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's why we've seen the rise of Instagram culture.
Or the Netflix, just how many Netflix, like,
Chef's Table, which I love. It's like, it's shot so gorgeously. Like, you can watch it with the sound off.
Yeah.
And just be like, oh, boy.
And then you point out Michael Pollan's series.
I think that has more. I mean, it's shot gorgeously.
Mm-hmm.
Just like, I think City of Gold is shot awesome.
Yeah, there's like, it's really a pretty. And also, like, this is the third time I've watched this movie. I've watched it online.
It and rewatched then it, as well.
Yeah, I watched it with a group of people, and like everyone at the end of it is just like kind of like salivating.
Yeah,
it's the closest thing to like pornography in right. a way. And we haven't done a lot of food documentaries. You know, because there's so many that are just about like factory farming's terrible.
Right.
Like,
I've watched all of those. I've watched all of those.
Or like all those things.
Yeah, those get pretty brutal.
Yeah.
I think what this movie does is just like it shows LA and kind of a true light, it shows beautiful shots of the food, but they're not like dollied up. Like you're getting the food like right in the kitchen. Like Chef's Table, it's like the lighting and the panning and the symphonic music.
It's like this, a car it's like, commercial.
This it's like it's well shot and they're obviously using good cameras, but it's like you feel like if you're just walking into Jitlada, you'd see what you'd see in this movie. So it's like it's not like they're not putting on a pedestal, but it still makes you hungry because you're like, wow, that looks good.
Yeah.
But it's not like some cinematic panning shot. It's just like, oh, there's food on a table.
Yeah.
And that looks fucking good.
There's a, like, it's also, I kept thinking, like, how small those kitchens are. And,
oh, my God.
How small, like, a taco truck is.
It's hard to shoot around chefs. And whoever shot this movie, I don't know who the director was or, I mean, they did a great job getting in there.
Cinematography is great in this thing. A lot of good LA shots, a lot of different neighborhoods.
All the B-roll, everything is great.
Yeah. So I think this is, like, definitely something, seeing this three times, I was like, I'm going to see this for a third time before I talk to Carl. Yeah. And I'm like, you know what? I'm just taking notes. There's so much stuff.
You love LA now, bro. You love it.
It did also make me think,
you're punk, damn. Bay Area, fucking disgust of the Southland is draining away by the day.
It's not even disgust. I mean, it's like, I was also thinking, I'm like, my relationship with where I am does have so much to do with, like, what are my spots, right? Like, you got to have that. And L.A. is such, like, a neighborhood right. spot.
L.A. is
place.
A city of these kind of enclosed communities, which they you know, cover in the movie. So it's like, unless you want to be driving all the time, you need to find a cool spot to be.
Yeah.
And you need to find shit around you that you love.
Yeah.
And if you don't have that, move to another neighborhood, because you'll find your thing.
Yeah. I mean, I'm, like, basically between the two UCBs.
Right.
We're near
you're in a great location.
The
here.
Vista, the Los Feliz 3, Jitlada, Ruin Pear.
Thai Town.
Which
love,
do you fuck with Ruin Pear?
Love Ruin Pear.
That's
Ruin Pear is my.
That's where I take people.
I love it. It's one of my top places.
We take people to Ruin Pear.
Shout
when
out
they
to
come
fucking
visit.
Ruin Pear. Also, Crispy Pork Gang.
You know
open
what?
24
have
hours.
Have we talked about Crispy Pork Gang?
On my podcast?
I think I've had like a weird Crispy Pork Gang. I'm not a
blue
huge
crab
fan.
Salad.
Okay.
Boom.
I have to do that. Have you been to all the spots that were in this movie?
Sure
or are there
have.
A couple you haven't done?
There's
okay.
Probably...
Did you do any because of the movie?
No.
Because Earl's Grill is no longer a thing, I think. That was the one.
I had it once years ago when he had the cart or the truck. But yeah, you're right. Earl's Grill
is gone.
Gayla Gaeta has become one of my favorite spots. Joel, who grew up in LA, my co-host for my podcast, has been going there for years.
Yeah.
We had one of the owners on our podcast.
Oh, really?
Shout out to Fernando. He's the man. He owns it with his sister, who's in this movie.
Yeah.
And Gayla Gaeta, I mean, it's like one James Beard Awards. At this point, it's an LA institution. But like, I remember going there for the first time, and I had never really had Oaxacan food before.
Yeah.
And it fucking blew me away. I mean, it's still one of my absolute favorite places to eat in the city.
My girlfriend, Angie, took me there because she was like, she knew about it.
Grasshoppers.
And I was like,
grasshoppers, mole, fucking
I did
playudas.
Not do the grasshoppers.
Grasshoppers are good.
You have to do the grasshoppers?
Oh, I always get the
horchata.
Birria. The birria. It's just spicy goat soup.
Okay.
And it just comes like in the spicy tomato consomme, a little bit of fixings on the side, like just some basic onion, cilantro, and then tortillas and just like meaty goat stew. And it's so good.
Yeah.
The grasshoppers are great. Obviously, all the moles, you know, big Oaxacan thing. The moles are awesome. Mm-hmm. Get that mole sampler. But, you know, I love drinking mezcal. So they have a fantastic
What is mezcal?
Mezcal is it's a agave spirit. So tequila is made from agave.
Uh-huh.
But mezcal, which, you know, every Mexican state kind of has its own, like, spirit. Like, we all know about tequila, but there's, like, Sotol and Bacanora, which use... Tequila has to be made from a certain type of agave, the Blue Weber agave. Mezcal, the way they make it is different than tequila. So what they do is the agave is like a cactus, and they cut the heart of the cactus out. They call it the piña because it looks like a pineapple. So you have these big fucking agave hearts. And with tequila, they're, you know, they're like cooked and then fermented. But with mezcal, they take them and they bury them in the ground
oh,
and they smoke them. So mezcal, a lot of people will compare. Okay. If tequila is whiskey, mezcal is scotch because it has a very smoky, complex profile that comes from them cooking these giant hearts of agave, the piñas, in the ground for days sometimes. Then they bring it out. Then they slice it up and ferment it. So, but like wine, it's a lot like you can taste like the regional differences, like the terroir. It's like, oh, this is from this side of the mountain and it's this kind. So it's like agave, I mean, mezcal.
Can you taste that shit in wine?
You can. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, like with if you do like a mezcal tasting at Galeguetza, you know, you're just sipping room temperature mezcal and and it's so satisfying. Like, you know, you're like tasting this and you're tasting that and you're like, oh yeah, I can this, you know, and they're all different types of agave. So it's like, oh, this is like the fucking Tepestate. And it's like, that's like this. And then, so like, just kind of like, you know, you're kind of going on a tour of the land through your taste buds, which I think, you know, what's more fun than that?
Like,
and you're drinking booze.
If you could have a job like being a taster, like a flavor guy,
I've worked as a bartender, and I know bartenders who've gone on to be like liquor reps. You know, you become like a rep for a company, and their job basically becomes to like travel around and drink. And you know, I know a guy who like works for a mezcal company. He gets like free trips to Oaxaca. You know, it's like that's like a thing you can do if you're like super gung-ho into it. Like, there's a place for you.
Yeah,
and obviously, you know, brand ambassadors for mezcal is a big thing now because mezcal in the last 5 years, big push for the American market. You know, a lot of people know what mezcal is compared to 5 years ago, and that's just going to keep growing and growing because it's a really good, I mean, it's a great spirit. It's versatile. It goes into cocktails. You can sip it. I mean, I love it.
My dad was a mezcal maker in Oaxaca, and things were going really bad for my dad in 93. And that's when the peso devalued. So there was a economic downfall in Mexico, so he decided to move here. So he just started kind of exploring LA, and in this area where we are right now, Koreatown, there was a lot of Latinos and a lot of people from Oaxaca that lived in the area. So my dad opened a little food stand, and it became very popular among people from Oaxaca because they just knew that's where you went to get Oaxacan food. So he was like, you know, let's open up a restaurant. It was this little hole in the wall, maybe like six tables, and we opened like a little alley. It was totally illegal. So one day, my dad walks in and was like, where are all these white people coming from? Because there was all these white people. Somebody was like, don't you know you were in the LA Times? In fact, Jonathan Gold reviewed the restaurant before the Spanish-speaking media. And now the restaurant's run by my sister, my brother, and myself, and we sit 300 people here.
This episode is brought to you by Philo. Do you love TV? Do you love saving money? Then Philo is your solution. Philo has shows, movies, and live TV for just $25 a month. You can even try it for free with their 7-day free trial. No contracts, no commitments, no hassles. Just a better way to watch TV. Never miss a minute of shows like the hit docuseries Where is Wendy Williams? Or classics such as Friends. If you can't get enough TV, then there's no better way to watch. Philo has more than 70 channels like BET, MTV, and AMC. And the best part? You can try it yourself with their 7-day free trial. Sign up today at philo.tv/poppods. That's philo.tv/poppods to get 50% off your first month.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Did you ever go to the Pok Pok in Chinatown?
Yes. Interesting thing about the Pok Pok. I could get into a whole discussion about this. So it closed.
Yeah.
And so, you know, Andy Ricker opened Pok Pok in Portland. It was a huge success. He's one of the most famous chefs in Portland. He opened it in New York. Big success. And then he opened here. It's going to be a huge space, kind of before this whole Chinatown wave, kind of just catching it. And he just couldn't keep it open.
I was wondering why.
And here's what I think. I mean, I've read a bunch about this. Mm-hmm. But first of all, everyone in LA knows about Thai food.
That's true.
We all like
it's not Portland.
I mean, it's like we have the most Thais here outside of Thailand. We have very good Thai food, and it's like Pak Pak's great. Like Andy Ricker's food is very good.
Mm-hmm.
But like, it's harder to care about a white guy coming in doing Thai food at some big new restaurant where it's like, I can just go to fucking Gelada. It's down the street from my house.
That's true. I did think that too. I'm like, what would I
also
be going?
I think he was like a year or two too early for this Chinatown thing that's kind of happening now with all these new openings.
What are the new spots in Chinatown?
So Eddie Huang opened his Bauhaus in Chinatown. It's all kind of centered around that Far East Plaza. Howlin' Ray's has become like a phenomenon.
You mean that is this the where the chicken place is?
What is the name of Roy Choi kind of kicked it off with Chago. And then, you know, Howlin' Ray's is like people are waiting 2 hours every day.
Oh, God, the lines are...
Eddie Huang opened Bauhaus. And then Alvin Kalin opened a Unit 120, like an incubator for young Filipino chefs, which has now just become Lhasa. He just gave it over to these guys. So he's kind of responsible for kicking off like this whole new Filipino thing happening. And then, you know, David Chang, major opening with Major Domo. Mm-hmm. There's a couple new spots that have opened. This place, Oriel, is kind of like a French bistro. So I think Andy Ricker, you know, 4 years ago was... maybe just a little too early. Plus, it was kind of, it was a little further in. It wasn't like right there on the strip.
And if you want Thai food, you come here.
And it was huge. Like it must have cost so much money to run, and like, and it was busy. Like I went there a couple times, and it was like it was packed. It was a very big space, but the amount of money to keep that open and just the labor, and I mean, this is LA. Like there's so much Thai options that I think it's just. It just didn't make sense.
It wasn't
for him to keep
the right, the right spot. I mean, there's like a pho place. There's a couple of pho places over there.
And he actually had another Pak Pak, just a place that did Pad Thai that was in the Far East Plaza, and that closed too.
Okay, he had two. He had two.
He had just done like a little noodle shop before he opened the big flagship spot.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's fascinating, and it's just a reminder that even high end like national level chefs, there's no guarantees. Like the restaurant business, even when you're banging on all cylinders, the profit margins are thin.
Yeah.
And especially with labor costs, like everything's changing. That's why we're seeing this big move, especially with big chefs, to fast casual, because no one, like labor is one of the biggest costs in the business. Mm-hmm. So it's like, if you can just have people order at a counter, that is what you fucking want. Because especially now with changing labor laws and you know, the minimum wage raising all the shit. Mm-hmm. So it's like, I mean, we've seen it the last 5 years and, you know, look for it in the next five, that fast casual and pared down concepts are going to be
kind of like Burger Lord in Chinatown.
Yeah,
and you have
guys just like Wes Avila walking away from fine dining jobs to open up little fucking holes in the walls or do bar food. Cause it's like working in fine dining kind of sucks. I mean, it's like, why wouldn't you want to be your own boss? Like, sure. There's plenty of chefs who want to do that and go do the crazy work at home, you know, all that shit. But like the guy who fucking Everson Royce Bar is like one of my favorite burgers in the city. That guy was working at like some of the best restaurants in the country, and then he was just like, you know what, I'm going to do bar food. They just designed a small tight bar menu that's amazingly executed, and Everson Royce Bar, the food there's fucking awesome. You go there, you have a drink, you have an amazing burger.
Mm-hmm.
Boom.
We're right around the corner from a bar that you do. You like the bar that's we're around the corner from?
You know, I like that there were wine selection, but I they could work on their food.
Yeah,
they could take some plays from the Everson Royce playbook.
Because like actually, there was also like a pop up fried chicken place,
Dave's Hot Chicken. They actually opened a restaurant.
They got a spot. Yeah,
yes, and that's
become, I never had it.
That's become the LA story. It's like Wes from Gorilla Tacos. You go from pop up to food truck to brick and mortar.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like that kind of path. That never really existed before. And, you know, with L.A. kind of being the birth of food truck culture, I think that's a very, like, quintessential L.A. story. Like, I started just selling burgers, and now there's all these Instagram pop-ups, like Trudy's Underground Barbecue and these Burgers Never Say Die guys. They literally do it on the weekends with their friends. Then it becomes huge. Then it becomes a thing, and now they're opening restaurants.
So you got to, like, give me a list of these Instagram ones.
So there's this place, Trudy's, and he's opening a huge barbecue restaurant called Slab, like with a major restaurant group in Hollywood. He started just doing barbecue on his driveway on the weekends on Instagram. It became like a fucking, there's like a couple other underground barbecue spots too. Ragtop Fern and all this shit. And then there's these Burgers Never Say Die guys are getting huge.
So like with those spots, they are doing it out of a house or something?
It's always like starts out at their house.
Yeah.
And these barbecue guys, you know, they have like a smoker in their driveway.
I remember like going to like these kind of like secret breakfast.
Yeah, like, it's like brunch, that.
Secret
it's
brunches.
Like, it's just right back to this DIY thing that we're talking about. It's like, what's cooler? And for the consumer, you feel cool because you're like, I followed him on Instagram, and then I found you feel like you've discovered something. Like you're part of something. You show up at someone's fucking house on a Saturday morning, and they have like a huge smoked beef rib, and you're like, everyone feels like they're part of it. You know, that's what people want.
And like brunches. Brunch can be kind of an easier thing. You can be pretty basic when
it
comes to brunch.
It's easy to go out with your friends and sit at a table and drink mimosas. But, like, you know, for the people who are really into food, it feels cool. Like, you went out there to the valley and went to some dude's house and got a special thing that only 20 people had that day. You know, so I think we're going to see more of that. And that goes right back to the decentralization and the DIY and the rise of Instagram. It's all coming together.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Instagram pop-ups. They do all their business over Instagram.
Yeah, like I just watched Ingrid Goes West, which is like... I
haven't seen it. Her is good.
It's a lot of Instagram-related stuff in there. But yeah, like I guess the barriers to starting. When I think there's a good line in this film. I forgot who said it, but it's like the miracle of entry-level capitalism.
Yeah, Jonathan Gold definitely says that at one point, and I think he's referring...
He's on the San Gabriel Valley, and...
Yeah, he's talking about the strip mall. He's talking about how LA, there's so many amazing restaurants that are in
Carousel
strip mall.
Carousel is a strip mall.
Yeah, I mean, and that's such a quintessentially LA thing. Yeah. Like, traditionally, strip mall, kind of shitty, bunch of shitty businesses. But like, in LA... It's, you know, like he's saying, that's the entry level. If you open something cool in strip mall and it catches on, you have a fucking good restaurant and it's in a strip mall.
But
I
do
mean,
you think
fucking
that's like,
Trois Mecs is in a strip mall.
But that's only since like the 2000s, you think? Or,
and I think it's kind of like, it's very symbolic because it's like, it's repurposing these kind of like drab consumer just like hives that originally just held like, you know, shitty, like not shitty, but just like, you know, run-of-the-mill businesses. Mm-hmm. And it's repurposed that and kind of like refracted it through, you know, people's love of food and kind of made it into its own thing. So now it's like, now no one blinks to go. I mean, and it's weird for people like my age or younger to hear about that because it's like, I mean, for me, I'm like, yeah, sure, strip mall, there's good shit. But like 10 years ago, someone would be like, we're going to a strip mall? What? And now it's like, yeah, of course. We just take it for granted that there's great food in strip malls. But I think that's, you know.
But that's partly Jonathan Gold, right?
Yeah,
that's
exactly. I mean, and Evan Kleinman, who has a good food, says that. She's like, yeah, like when you like when I used to go to these restaurants that Jonathan would recommend, I'd be like, what? Is it here? Like, what? Mm-hmm. And then you'd eat there and you'd be like, oh, fuck.
This is I'm trying to think of like food writing that I even was a reader of before. I mean, there'd be like kind of like alt weeklies would have columnists
I mean,
my
first,
and stuff.
My first exposure was, you know, the Squid Ink in LA Weekly, RIP. I mean, we've lost LA and LA Weekly.
Yeah.
And, you know,
you so interviewed like, the guy from Eater, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, Eater has become the rise of Eater is kind of.
They're filling a void.
Right. They're filling a void of you know, food has become hot and you know, millennials want information about food, and Eater has kind of risen on the backs of people's desire for information, you know, like, and now it's, I mean, I read Eater all the time, you know, keep up on openings, closings, new shit. They have content. I mean, yeah, the story of the rise of Eater is a story of like a public that's hungry, you could say, for information about shit. And it's like, we've lost LA Weekly. We've lost LAist. Like, like
major outlets.
The traditional outlets you would look to for like, I used to love the LA Weekly food section. Like I would devour, literally devour that, you know, Squid Ink. I'd sit
Carl's
down.
Carl's a comedian.
I'd be like, I'm a professional comedian, folks. I would sit down and really just, I would look forward to it, you know, every week. And I would be like, what's, you know, like what? And then I'd be like, I want to go to that. What's this? What this is, you know, and we don't have that anymore. Like the LA Weekly got gutted by these right-wing investors.
Yeah, these Orange County
LAist was closed
guys.
Down by like some vengeful billionaire.
Oh God,
like, this is like, it's all so shitty. And
it all happened in the same, in the span of like a month.
And we're
both
the ones, you know, the
happened.
Consumers are the ones who lose out because it's like, you
and
know.
In a way, it's like more of an opportunity for people to check out Yelling About Pate.
That's true. Podcasts are the new journalism, folks.
I mean, they
we're
kind of are,
here.
Actually.
I mean, thank God you still have J. Gold at LA Times. You have
LA Times is going through a whole thing now because like they've been really anti-unionization and they're owned
they
by
just
Trump.
Unionized.
They did. They voted to unionize
recently,
right? The
which
writers,
is good.
Yeah,
good. More power to unions.
Yeah.
But yeah, and I think that again dovetails into like, you know, you're not going to read about a fucking Instagram barbecue pop up on, you know, in a newspaper probably.
Right.
you might hear about it on Eater, but like more likely your friend's going to tell you about it.
Yeah.
And these things spread through word of mouth.
It's almost like so quaint that being a newspaper writer is the thing that he's doing. Like,
right.
That's like,
right.
That's one thing that's kind of bizarre about it. It's like,
right. This, yeah, he's a newspaper man.
Yeah. But he's like disrupting something, right, in traditional food journalism.
Right.
And then at the same time, this
but
entire
then he
industry
has become a traditional food journalist.
Yeah, within like two decades,
right,
or something. But,
and not just that, like the only one to win a Pulitzer Prize, like arguably, yeah, like one of the top food journalists in the country.
Yeah, I guess like Lucky Peach was also probably,
yeah, which closed. Lucky Peach closed
down
over the holidays. Like
they're kind of like Grantland or something too. It's
right,
almost like this idea that's
right,
like it's kind of high minded.
We're in this weird new media landscape,
yeah,
where it's just like things pop up and then they disappear and it's
totally
like, what's going on? And
I mean, I think about, I was also just thinking, you know, there's just all this news about MoviePass, and like that's like a huge thing right now because MoviePass has like disrupted the movie,
right,
industry.
I keep hearing about it. I don't really, I know you buy it and then you can go to,
it costs about as much as Netflix,
right,
to go to a movie a day.
I always hate, like,
you can
when something like that works, I'm like, you know, this is just emboldening those Silicon Valley bros who say disruption,
yeah,
a lot.
Yeah.
And you know they love it. And
well,
now there's just going to be more of them.
It's exactly like Uber, right? It's like
venture
capital.
Bro.
It's just venture. And like, if you, my grandma owned a restaurant. I mean, she had like the only Chinese restaurant in Palos Verdes,
okay,
in the 80s,
right,
basically. And she had run like, she had a very weird background. Like she had done like some journalism and stuff, but she just started like an ice cream parlor in San Jose when I was a kid. And then she moved down here and like her and my grandpa, who's white, like not my, you know, but her,
right,
her husband, my grandpa, and maybe it was easier for them to start a restaurant because he was white and kind of like this,
right,
you
Palos Verdes,
knew
very
how to,
wealthy
Republican dude,
white
knew,
neighborhood,
knew how to like deal with some of the, you know, probably like the paperwork of it. But they were like the only game in town for a long time.
Yeah, if you wanted Chinese food in Palos Verdes,
yeah, that was it. People know
head Golden, down to Chance.
People were like Golden Lotus. Yeah, we know what Golden Lotus is. Like, shout out to anyone who remembers
Golden Lotus. There you go.
At this point, it's been closed for years, but I think it's a Trader Joe's in there now. But yeah, like coming from seeing that, she tried to do another restaurant, and it fucking tanked.
A non-Chinese,
like, right away. Yeah, it was like Italian themed,
okay,
in that, like, kind of in that area. Right. It was called Mona Lisa, and like, I don't think it lasted 2 months. Like, it was just like,
Jay Gold never made it there.
Painful. No, yeah, I mean, it's,
you know, Jay Gold ate a Golden Lotus.
I'm pretty sure,
like,
he would
have tell of some place in Palos Verdes. I'm going to drive down there in my truck and investigate.
And my grandma, she still has a photo of her and my grandpa standing with John Travolta. Like, I think they were shooting something.
If Travolta
there
comes in, you got to stand with him. I
yeah,
love these. I love Korean barbecue, and my favorite place is Parks, and the walls are just covered with, mm-hmm, like celebrities who come in. I just love that. It's like, oh, there's Keanu Reeves. Ooh, Keanu loves this place.
Does any Korean place down here do a thing that I have not had it down here in Oakland and Korean places? It's known as cheese corn.
Oh, yeah.
Basically,
that's
mac and cheese.
You see that at a lot of barbecue spots.
Yeah.
They put it on the gutters of the grill and the juice drops in,
okay,
and it melts and it gets all.
Yeah, it's just like a buttery,
yeah,
mac and cheese,
yes,
but corn. Yeah.
Dude,
oh, my gosh.
Koreatown's the best. I mean, just like Jay Gold, I've really, mm-hmm, really just become obsessed with Korean food.
Yeah, there's a hagfish scene in here, which they talk about hagfish. That's the Lucky Peach piece, right?
Right.
He's pitching. Well, it's pretty disgusting and doesn't taste very good, and it's really slimy. Who would you cast to play Jonathan Gold in a biopic of Jonathan Gold?
I feel like I'd have to go with Goodman, because you need a man of considerable carriage. You know, Jay Gold's a bigger man, and I think that narrows the field. I mean,
yeah,
obviously, you could have someone wear padding. That's kind of dumb. I think Goodman would fucking kill it.
Yeah. I mean,
first of all, I love Goodman.
Yeah.
I think he's such a good actor. I think he'd be like perfect.
It's weird. He's kind of got a little darkness to him. Maybe because I'm just thinking
Goodman's
Barton
a little
Fink
bit like lower and gruffer. And,
yeah,
and Jacob's kind of more like a little reserved,
yeah,
and a little.
Personality wise, I'm not sure. Like,
yeah, but
who
Goodman's
would
an accomplished
do
actor. He could.
Yeah,
you know,
Goodman could totally do it for sure.
I'm trying to think who else, like, you know, who's like a little heavier in the character actor world.
I thought of this one, and also my girlfriend also agreed with this one. Like, if Philip Seymour Hoffman was around,
oh my god,
would nail
it.
Nail
I didn't
this
even think of that. He would be perfect.
Well, because yeah, the rule of the game is pretty much anyone who's been a living.
Yeah, but you could say Philip Seymour Hoffman for anybody.
Pretty much any documentary.
Yeah,
I think it, like, he fits the bill. And then she had another one, which is like physically not exactly, but facially, Toby Jones, the guy from Detectorists.
I don't know.
I'll pop up a picture of him real fast.
Kelsey or Hoffman would be great.
Yeah.
I used to play cello.
It's not how he sounds at all. I don't even know what that was.
Yeah.
It's hard to do like a... John,
it's hard.
John Nichols is very laid back. He's like, they do a sort of noodle...
You'll recognize this guy.
Spicy noodle.
Well, both of them have played Truman Capote.
Oh, yeah.
That was
this
kind of
guy
the idea.
Fucking rules.
He's kind of a smaller
but he's
dude.
Tiny.
He's like, little, he's, but like facially, he's kind of
I don't
got.
Think it would, I don't think. I don't physically. I don't think.
Physically,
it
doesn't quite match up. I did
actor.
Have a casting for his brother Mark, the guy who's all about saving
yes,
seafood.
Mark the environmentalist,
who is like I guess the younger brother. I say Pete Holmes, which is not.
I could see
100%
that. 100%
on.
Damn, Philip Seymour Hoffman and Pete Holmes sitting in a restaurant talking about their childhood. That's what I'm talking about. I'd watch
yeah.
that.
And like his wife is such a character, and his kids are such characters. I couldn't really think of anyone specifically to play them, but you know, they're a big part of the story too. I mean,
yep.
I was thinking about this movie. It's like it doesn't make sense to look at it chronologically. Like, it's not like the life of Jonathan Gold from childhood
right.
to adulthood. It's like, here's a guy, and then you kind of just get some backstory as
it's
you go.
Kind of vignettes, much like the like little vignettes about the city, which
mm-hmm.
the overall style is kind of lends itself to describing LA, because LA is kind of like disparate and atomized
yeah.
like that. So it's like each little section of this movie can kind of stand on its own.
Yeah, like I was trying to like actually this is my third time watching, I was like kind of like seeing how one clip leads into a theme, like because
yeah.
like I've seen enough. I'm like, oh, that's gonna lead into
right.
this thing, and so
really well done. Who directed this movie?
Laura Gabbert's her name. I think she's done a couple other documentaries.
Okay, I'll have to watch her other
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, I was gonna try to get her to do the show, but now we're doing this, so you know, whatever. I mean, it is a really well put together. The cinematography, like there's
yeah.
like kind of I guess drone shots of LA
yeah,
or
gorgeous
amazing
shots
looking.
Of LA. Great, very well composed.
I mean, this is like there's nothing. I don't think there's anything bad to say about this documentary at
no.
all.
No, if you love food, you love LA. Even if you don't know who Jonathan Gold is, I mean, I feel like a
it
lot of people come to this movie
yeah.
knowing Jonathan Gold and his work. But like, if I didn't know anything about it and just sat down, I'd be like, fuck, I
all
I wanna,
you need to know
makes
is
you
want to like,
eat. It makes
yeah.
you want to read Jonathan Gold shit.
Yeah, he's the first food journalist to get a Pulitzer.
There you go.
Like, that's kind of all you need to know. And
yep.
this, I'd say this episode of this podcast might be the first episode of a podcast.
What do you mean?
To get a Pulitzer.
Dude, I'm telling you, within our lifetime, someone's winning a podcast Pulitzer.
Yeah, for sure.
It's going to happen.
Yeah, so Carl, I think that's a good place to put
yes.
a pin in this.
This has been a goddamn
where are you
going
to eat after this?
What
are you thinking?
Hard to say. I'm in Thai Town now. I mean,
yeah.
now it's,
Ruined
it's
Pear,
a pretty easy
we just
call.
Talked about.
Ruined Pear. I mean, you know, there's so many spots. Ruined Pear is a fucking go-to if I'm in Thai Town.
Oh, my God.
I go to Song. I go to Night Market Song so much that,
right.
like, that's kind of become my like go-to for Thai. So I'm not over here a ton, but, like, Ruined Pear is really a go-to for me.
You know, right by Bigfoot Lodge in Atwater, that Indian place?
No, I've never been
India's
there.
India's Sweets and Spices?
Oh, no, I have been there. That place
that's
is good.
Great.
Yeah.
When I would do the occasional times I would get booked on Babe Island.
Yeah, you stop by first.
yeah.
That's a vegetarian place, right?
It is vegetarian, but it's affordable.
Right, yeah.
Yeah,
there's one of them in Culver City,
I took Miles
too.
And Jesse Elias there. Once.
Good
yeah,
food.
Yeah, very good. And your podcast, Yelling About Pate.
Yeah, Yelling About Pate.
Do you say Pate? I say Pate. Like Pate Smith.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Pate Smith. That's actually pretty funny. Yeah,
Yelling About
Pad
Thai. We should just do a sub
right.
episode.
Yelling About Pad Thai.
In this neighborhood, we'll just go
Yelling
to...
Yelling About Patty Smith. I think you can bring it to anything. Yeah, we do. We release once a week. You can follow us on Instagram at YapPod. That's YAPPOD. I am at Carl Hess on Instagram. Love Instagram.
Yeah,
big
more than
Instagram
Twitter.
Fan.
You're doing your Instagram.
I mean, I have
Twitter.
More followers on Twitter, but like, I
yeah.
enjoy Instagram more.
Yeah.
I'm also at Carl Hess on Twitter. Yeah, I mean, the Yelling About Pate Instagram has become just like my dump for food pictures.
Okay,
so if you want to, because otherwise I'm just
I'll
posting
see where you are. Yeah.
Otherwise I'm just bombarding people who don't care.
Yes.
I feel like the people who are following that account, they're like, they care about food.
Yeah,
I'm gonna post 5 food pictures a day. I don't care.
I throw my cat pictures in my feed. That's
yeah,
all
there
I
you
got,
go.
Even though we have a distinct cat one. Cool. Thanks so much for being on the show,
Thanks
Carl.
For having me, man. I
yeah.
appreciate it. Now I'm fucking hungry.
Yeah. We'll go eat. Thanks for listening.
You can find more episodes of Sup Doc, show notes, updates, and more
at supdocpodcast.com.
We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at supdocpodcast.
If you have comments, corrections, or want to suggest a documentary, email us at supdocpodcast@gmail.com.
The show is listener supported. You can donate to the show at patreon.com/supdocpodcast.
If you can't donate financially, please subscribe, comment, or tell a friend about SupDoc.
We'd like to thank Documentary News for their ongoing support.
SupDoc is produced by Will Scovel.
Our theme music is by David Siegel.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.